Broadcasting live from atop the Rocky Mountains, the crossroads of the West. You are listening to the Liberty Roundtable Radio Talk Show.
All right. Happy to have you along, my fellow Americans. Sam Bushman live on your radio. Hard-hitting news the networks refuse to use, no doubt, continues now. This is the broadcast for April 29th, the year of our Lord, 2024. This is Hour 2 of 2, the goal always to protect life, liberty, and property, to promote God, family, and country, using the supreme law of the land, the Constitution for the United States of America, the checks and balances brilliantly put in place by the Founding Fathers, and incredible peaceful solutions we still have at our fingertips. We reject revolution unless it's a Jesus revolution. Then we're in. We follow the Prince of Peace. Incredible first hour with Dr. Scott Bradley, freedomsrisingsun.com. And now our dear friend Lowell Nelson, campaignforliberty.org, joins us. Welcome to the broadcast, sir.
Ah, good to be with you, Sam. Thank you for having me.
Well, you probably lack sleep. Turns out that Lowell attends the Utah Republican Party nominating convention, and boy, howdy, was it a late night, huh, sir?
Wow, we went from 7 in the morning, which is when credentialing began, until midnight, Sam. I couldn't believe it. Who thought that any convention would take until midnight? And we didn't even get to any of the platform change proposals, any rule change proposals, any resolutions. All we got done were the elections. Of course, that's probably the most important part, but that's all we got done. And we went, I guess it was called to order at about noon, and 12 hours later, we left that convention hall. Longest convention in my history, Sam, and I've been attending these for well over 20 years, every single year, and this was just, it was crazy, Sam. I mean, they had problems.
And it's designed on purpose to be long. What their goal is, to make it longer and longer and longer, more fraught with difficulty, trouble, confusion. That's what they want, because they really want the delegates to go home and not take part in this at all. That's what their real goal is. So they want to frustrate the heck out of you. We've proven over and over and over that going to electronic voting machines is a disaster. This time proved no different. It took a bunch of time to sort all that out, wasting hours for all the delegates, right?
Exactly what happened. In fact, as I noticed, the number of votes cast as the evening wore on, we were losing about 25 delegates per round of voting. So I'm serious, like 15 minutes between rounds of voting, and there are roughly 25 fewer delegates voting every round as the night wore on, because some people had taken tracks up to the convention center. Well, the last tracks train was like at 10:30 or something, and they had to catch their ride. Other people, they just wore out, and they went home. And
other people have commitments. They expected it to take what normal conventions used to take, and now it's totally changed. As they ran it off the rails, pardon the pun, you can't take the rails after they ran it off the rails, and it's just crazy town. But break down a little bit about the electronic voting, because we're just seeing this. You say there's no problem. This is the safest, most secure election we've ever had. That's what they pointed to in 2020. But even this small, how many delegates are there?
4,000 delegates total.
All right. So 4,000 is a pretty small reality, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, it's okay. A lot of people. Yeah, to handle in such a short time.
You have 4,000, you break it up into pieces for vote counters, though, and you could count this very quickly. But, of course, they went to electronic machines, and the machines had problems, and it took forever to get people trained and reset and recalibrated. And I mean, that's the story here, right?
Well, I kid you not, Sam. That's exactly right. The 2012 was the first convention where we used electronic voting, and these little clickers were what we used. Everybody thinks that electronic voting is faster, but here are two specific reasons, substantive reasons why it is not faster. Number one is that you have to train people on how to use the clickers, and then you always have a test vote. And during that test vote, people with bad clickers or bad connections on their phone or whatever, depending if you're using clickers, it doesn't matter if you're using telephones or websites, whatever, there's a certain amount of training. And it usually takes about an hour, from 45 minutes to an hour, to conduct that voting test and to get everybody up to speed on how to cast a vote. So that's 1 hour down the drain. And then the second big substantive reason is that in order to conduct electronic voting, you have a receiver, right? And this receiver receives the votes cast by the 4,000 delegates. or the 1,000 delegates if you're doing a congressional district election. And so because there's only one receiver, that means that everybody has to stay in the main convention hall and in order for their votes to be counted. Well, before we went to electronic clickers, Sam, we used to divide up, we'd split up into our congressional districts in different halls. And so this CD1 would go, you know, hither, and CD2 would go yon, and CD3 would stay in the main convention hall. I mean, there were separate venues for each congressional district caucus. So,
this mirrors, by the way, this mirrors the precincts of America. Mm-hmm. Bring it to the smallest common denominator you can. It makes it easiest to count, easiest to confirm and validate, and it's they're obliterating all that in this.
That's right, because now they have to do it because there's only one receiver, and they have to do all the CD elections in the main hall. So that means three-fourths of those 4,000 delegates are sitting around twiddling their thumbs while one congressional district has all the speeches and conducts all the multiple rounds of balloting, and it takes an hour or two. And so you've now wasted the time of 3,000 delegates, a couple of hours of their time. And then you do say CD2, and then you do CD3, right? And so it used to be that once your congressional district election was over, you went home. And it was because you heard the speeches, you cast your ballot, and if you didn't have additional rounds of voting, then you were done. And it was so much better, Sam. And the other thing we did in 2002, 2003, and 2004 was that we cast ranked choice ballots, or preferential ballots. So there, everybody had a preference. And so you didn't have drop-off, people leaving the convention, not being able to vote in subsequent rounds of voting. Because ranked choice voting is exactly the same as multiple round voting, except you don't
need all the rounds taking all the time, right?
Exactly. So we used to get out mid-afternoon. Our conventions before 2012 usually got out mid-afternoon. The longest ones were late afternoon, talking maybe 3:30, 4 o'clock. And then after we started electronic voting, we never got out till 5 or 6 o'clock. And then I tell you what, Saturday's convention, midnight. Could not believe it, Sam. Horrendous.
Amen to that. So that's a reality check on a local, simple level statewide for Utah. You need to dig into your state and see, are the same things happening in all 50 states across the union? And how come we're literally forcing all the candidates to sit there through all the different districts and all the different things that doesn't even relate to their delegation or their authority, their responsibility at all? They're just sitting there sidelined. Why do they have to train for an hour to use a clicker and calibrate and test the voting system? And okay, you could have vote counters that can't, you said it was like 1,000 delegates per given representative in Utah. That's easy. You get 5 counters. They each count 200 votes. You have vote watchers. They swear under the penalty of perjury and record the whole thing so it can go back and be reviewed. This is very simple. If you count 200 votes, it can't take you more than an hour, hour and a half to count anyway. So this is very simple to solve, right?
That's right, Sam. And most of our county conventions, in fact, all of them, as far as I know, maybe except Salt Lake County, did paper ballots. And I was in the counting room. I was one of the election helpers, I guess, workers in my own county convention. And we had, I don't know, about 10 teams of people, about 10 pairs, 20 workers. And we went out, collected the ballots in our ballot boxes, came into the counting room, dumped the box out onto the table, separated those ballots into separate stacks. First we separated into races, and then each race we separated into stacks, one stack for each candidate. And then it's a very simple matter to combine those from the 10 tables, because we had 10 pairs of workers. You just combine, you gather the stacks of ballots for each of the candidates, and you weigh them, believe it or not, because every ballot has a specific weight. And so,
yeah, which I have a problem with anyway, though. I want to count them.
Okay. And obviously, if you have two stacks that are nearly equal, then yeah, we would count those. But basically, if they're not even close, then you simply weigh them, divide by the weight of a single ballot, and thereby you know exactly the number of ballots cast for that candidate. So it's
Rather see it counted, and I'd rather see every ballot on the screen, and I'd rather be able to document it, and I'd rather have people swear under the penalty of perjury to its accuracy. Because weighing the votes doesn't tell you if it's a legitimate ballot or not at all.
Yeah. Well, in the case where we counted them, then the counters, each pair would count the ballots on their table before giving them up to be weighed. And so there was a double count. So you weigh them and count them. So that
Well, I'm fine with the weighing as an extra measure, but a lot of times they weigh these to circumvent the counting, which I have a problem with.
Yeah, I know on our table we counted before we weighed them.
Love it. Go ahead and skip the break. There were some results. So we talked about the process and how problematic it has become, and I believe it's intentional, Lowell, to drive people away from this sacred responsibility and their duty and the service of delegates and everything else. They want to circumvent the delegate process. The proof in the pudding is what happened, right?
Yeah, the proof is there. And some great things happened. Obviously, our incumbent governor, our he-him pronoun governor, Cox, he has a challenger named Phil Lyman, who's currently a legislator. In fact, he was the legislator, state legislator, but he, as county commissioner of San Juan County, he is the gentleman who staged a rally for the county roads that were in his county that the BLM had declared were now public roads and that the county had could no longer maintain. And he was arrested because of that. He spent some time in jail. President Trump pardoned him. Anyway, demonstrating to me that he has courage, he has backbone, and he's willing to stand up against the feds and do what's right. It's not right for the feds to just come and say, okay, this is our property now. You county guys go take a hike. I mean, that was not right. The federal government has no authority to do that in the state of Utah. And so Phil Lyman, he stood up to them, and as our governor, he will stand up to them again and again. So Phil Lyman won the party's nomination with 2/3 of the vote. Governor Cox, who got booed a number of times during his speech, only got 1/3 of the delegate vote. Cox said during his speech, of course, he reminded the delegates that there are many governors before him who had got booed by the delegates who went on to win the primary. And so, yeah, it's sort of like he was taunting the
delegates. Well, let's talk about the primary. So usually if you have over a certain amount of votes, then there's no primary, right?
That's the way it used to be before.
Trent got enough to make sure that happened, right?
Phil got enough to make sure that did not happen, but...
But in the new world, sir.
Yeah, yeah. In the new world, which occurred in 2014, in the spring of 2014, the Utah legislature passed this Senate Bill 54, which said that anybody could basically buy their way onto the primary ballot by collecting a certain number of signatures. So the gubernatorial candidate, he has to collect 28,000 signatures from people in Utah, and that's what Governor Cox did. He paid people to go gather signatures for him, so he's going to be on the ballot no matter what the party does in convention. Well, the party delegates, they studied both Cox and Lyman, felt that Lyman was better qualified to be our governor. So 2/3 of the delegates thought that. Only
and this was all 4,000 of them that voted on this part, right?
Correct. That's correct. Yep. And so they're both going to show up on the primary, which will be decided on June 25th. That's 8 weeks from now, 7.5 weeks. And so it's going to be
And
difficult.
This is how they commit election fraud, folks. I hate to just point this out, but look, you used to have 4,000 people who were I don't want to say appointed, but voted on by the people in the precincts to be delegates, to represent them, to go ahead and, okay, that's a check and balance. They've now circumvented that check and balance. So even though they lost 2/3 to 1/3, they can still get on the ballot, and now the people vote, and the whole first vote of the delegation is really irrelevant now, right? Why even have it?
That's right. And it used to be that, and just so you know, it's not a majority vote by convention. See, the convention in years past or before 2014 said that if you don't get 60%, then the two who get between 40 and 60%, they go on the primary ballot, and we'll let the Republican voters decide which of those two should proceed on to the general election. But if delegates decide that, you know, if 60% or more of the delegates feel that one candidate is better than another, then that one candidate becomes the party's nominee and goes on to the general election. So
and what's going to happen is even though Phil Lyman won 2/3 of the vote there, plenty to go straight to the election. Now there's going to be a primary because the way they changed the law to where now if you got a lot of money, all you got to do is get on the ballot. Now you have a challenge. That's election fraud because we basically violated a check and balance. And now Phil's probably going to lose. I hate to say this to Phil because I love him and I support him 1,000%. But I'm telling you, he's going to probably lose on the 25th of June because what they'll do is use the media to ramp up Cox, to down Lyman at every turn. They'll use that media, that manipulation, that dishonesty, that change in the rules in 2014 to where Lyman will probably lose, be damned, pardon the French, what the delegates say.
Now, good news here, Sam, is that Phil Lyman has $640,000 in his campaign account. This is a report prior to convention, and Spencer Cox has $800,000 in his war chest. Spencer Cox had raised $1.5 million. He spent half of that basically, so he's got half of it left. And of course, they'll get more donations from this point on. But that's kind of where it stood at the time of the convention. Phil Lyman had raised $830,000. He had spent $190,000, leaving him with $640,000. And so the good news is that the challenger here has a real shot. I mean, you don't have to match dollar for dollar in order to win. It's just, it's important. I mean, if you only had like $1,000, then there'd be no chance.
Yeah, you need to have enough money to be a real player, which Phil has, which is great. Yep. What he doesn't have is a fair shot at the media. Right. And then the other thing he doesn't have that I, as far as I can tell, is incumbency. So the incumbent already has an advantage, right?
That's right. You know, 5 or 10 percentage point advantage for all incumbents. It's a very difficult hill to climb for a challenger to beat an incumbent. Even if that incumbent is not that popular, it turns out that everybody knows that Governor Cox is our governor. And when they go to the polls, the low information voter just goes to the poll and says, oh, okay, Cox, I seem to remember. I think he's our governor. He's probably doing an okay job, so I'll vote for him. That's kind of the thought process of a lot of our people, unfortunately. So it's sad that we have this this election fraud going on, this signature
Yeah, the Mitt Romney
route.
Sorry to interrupt. I just want to really hurry because you've got so much today that I want to make sure we get to.
Okay.
Spencer Cox really putting his name on the ballot and forcing it to the primary by hook and by crook. What a shame that is. In the Utah U.S. Senate race where Mitt Romney is vacating, the same realities are haunting us now. Lol?
Yes, that's true, because Trent Staggs, the current mayor of Riverton, he won the nomination with 70% of the vote, Sam. That's even more than 2/3. However, U.S. Representative John Curtis, who got only 30% of the delegate vote, he gathered signatures, and so he will be on the primary ballot, as will Jason Walton, who looks like a liberty-loving candidate, by the way, and also Brad Wilson, former Speaker of the Utah House. So that's a crowded primary. He's got four people on the primary ballot. You got Trent Staggs, who won the delegate, 70% of the delegate vote, plus John Curtis, who is a current U.S. representative, so he has some of the power of an incumbency going into this U.S. Senate race. And then you've got Jason Walton and Brad Wilson. Now, Brad Wilson is sort of like Mitt Romney light. And so what I'm hoping, Sam, is that Brad Wilson and John Curtis will cannibalize each other's votes and that Terrence Staggs will be able to win.
Jason Walton, you're right. But my prediction is that Trent Staggs will lose, that John Curtis will win, that Cox will win, and Lyman will lose because they've rigged the system to ensure that outcome, virtually so with the mainstream press. Now, hopefully we can get an upset. Hopefully there's the equivalent mandates for the 2/3 and 70% for these two candidates. Hopefully the mandates of the delegation will win. But I'm telling you from experience that with the media manipulation and lies, and then when they go ahead and put these people on the ballot who have no business being there in the first place based on the checks and balances, that's the difference between a democracy and a constitutional republic. You see, a constitutional republic, we put these delegates in place who then vet the candidates who have a lot more knowledge about the details and the inner workings and the actions taken hitherto by these candidates or by these people. They study them. They know. When you have a 70% mandate against an incumbent, the incumbent already has, as we mentioned, a 5 to 10 point advantage as a result. That is a mandate. That is a landslide for Trent Staggs and for Phil Lyman. However, As you can see, not so fast, not so easy. Because so I hope that I'm wrong, lol. But I'm telling you, it'll be a very, very difficult uphill battle for both of these candidates, regardless of the overwhelming support by the delegates.
You got that right, Sam. Absolutely do. The U.S. Senate race, they've got even more money in there, just for your information. John Curtis has $1.3 million at his disposal right now. Brad Wilson has $2.06 million. So Brad Wilson has even more money than John Curtis. So we're talking $1 million, $2 million, and Trent Staggs is sitting there with $500,000. So it's going to be a very difficult race for him.
But between all of them, you're talking about $3, $4 million being thrown into a race. It's all about money and media now.
Exactly.
Because the checks and balances have been destroyed, lol.
Mm-hmm. Yep, the Republican form of government that brought Utah such great prosperity and peace over the decades past is now gone, and it's really sad to see, but now it's going to be money that determines who's our winner, not substance. Sam?
It's money, and it's also media, because remember, media translates to money. Okay, yeah, when you promote exactly a specific candidate till the cows come home, you got to realize what kind of dollars in kind got applied to that. That's media promotion, commercials, the list goes on and on and on. And they're playing games with that, too. And I'm telling you, the two candidates with all that money have the ability to bend the media's ear, because money translates into extra money in kind, so to speak. And that, again, is a serious, serious problem. And now, I wish we could level the playing field. I wish we had a big enough stick to do that, so to speak. Because we aren't really promoting candidates based on money or based on, you know, a number of signatures, or we're looking at the delegates, and we're also looking at the constitutionality of a candidate, just like the delegates are. All that's thrown out the window when you take voters that don't have a history of the record. They're just like, oh, Spencer Cox, I saw him the other day. He's a friend of my grandma's, or he's this or that, or, you know, he looked good in his caravan last week and whatever. They don't really understand the historical reality of a candidate, and or the promises or the lack of keeping those promises or the constitutionality of a candidate. All that stuff kind of goes out the window by the time you get to the masses with media manipulation, lol.
Yeah, that's for sure. But there is one thing that we can do, folks, and that's the grassroots. If they'll get out and go visit their neighbors, talk it up, their colleagues and neighbors and friends, then the grassroots, the common everyday people, just like you and me, Sam, we can make a huge difference in the election. If we do nothing, if we sit on our thumbs and expect media and advertising to win this for Phil, he will not win. But if we'll go and talk to our neighbors and make sure they know Phil's the better candidate, then Phil will have a chance at winning.
And I recommend that individuals need to challenge the media, mm-hmm, too. When there's a big old media promotion of whatever, I think that, mm-hmm, people need to call their media and say, hey, you know what? And express their displeasure. Don't be rude. Don't be offensive. Don't be crazy. But just simply say, listen, I don't think this is fair the way this is being covered. You know, we want, for example, Phil Lyman in the debates. Mm-hmm. We want, you know, Trent Staggs in the debates. We want people to be able to hear what these people have to say and do. You know what? And we demand accountability here. If the people are involved enough, our greater numbers, we can't be stopped. The only question left is, will the people be involved, or will it just be money that kind of rules the day? I don't know. And I don't mean to be negative about this, but I do want to really let people know the reality of what we're facing. Because they've changed the laws, now they claim it's not election fraud. But what they've really done is they basically created the law to support election fraud, and then they hide that fact under, quote, the law. And Americans that don't understand what happened in 2014 don't even realize what's been done to them, lol.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. I mean, if you're an up-and-coming voter and just barely getting into the game right now, you would have no memory, no recollection of how it was before 2014.
Or if you're not watching and you don't know the details from the beginning, how do you know the details when they change, right? Anyway, yeah. The final nail in America's coffin, Ron Paul. We'll talk about that in seconds. You are listening to the one and only Lowell Nelson, campaignforliberty.org on Liberty Roundtable Live.
Pursuing liberty, using the Constitution as our guide. You're listening to Liberty News Radio.
USA News, I'm Ryan Daniels. There are reports of a possible new agreement to pause the fighting between Israel and Hamas and allow for hostage releases in Gaza. The Paris-based news agency AFP is citing a Hamas official who spoke on condition of anonymity. They said that Hamas has no major issues with a new proposal from Israel and Gaza. Negotiators from Egypt and Qatar are meeting in Cairo Monday with U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken. Meanwhile, President Biden and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu spoke at length by phone Sunday night. Hannah Siegel, whose uncle Keith is a U.S.-Israeli citizen being held hostage by Hamas, joined CBS News and said while she thinks a deal can get done to release more hostages, she's also a bit skeptical.
Ultimately, this is a negotiation between Hamas and Prime Minister Netanyahu in Israel. And one of the things that really worries my family and worries me is that it's arguably not in Prime Minister Netanyahu's political interest to close a deal.
A Biden-Trump debate could be in the works. USA's John Schaefer with more.
President Biden expressed his willingness to debate Donald Trump before the November presidential election. He made the statement Friday during an interview with radio host Howard Stern.
I am somewhere, I don't know when. I'm happy to debate him.
Trump, who declined to participate in the Republican primary debates, has stated on social media that he is ready to debate Biden anytime, anywhere, any place.
Officials in Oklahoma say at least four people are dead after a weekend tornado outbreak. Two were killed when a large twister hit the small town of Holdenville, about 60 miles southeast of Oklahoma City. Governor Kevin Stitt toured several hard-hit communities Sunday, calling the devastation unbelievable. He also declared a state of emergency for a dozen counties Sunday. This is USA News.
Hey, here's a question. After you wear your clothes, you toss them in the washing machine, right? Nobody wants to wear dirty clothes. So how do we don't throw your shoes in the washing machine when they get dirty? I mean, come on. Your shoes are touching the filthy ground all day long. Gross. But with Skechers, you can. Because most Skechers are machine washable. That's right. Skechers are specially made so you can toss them right in the washing machine and keep them clean and looking new. And when they look new, you can confidently wear them longer. That's less shoes you're going to want to throw away, which means less waste. And it'll save you tons of dough. I love that. Plus, machine washable Skechers are for the whole family, men, women, and kids. So when your kids get their shoes dirty, oh, and we know they will, just wash them. Brilliant! And even our latest technology, new hands-free Skechers slip-ins are washable. You just step right in and go without bending down or even touching your shoes. So give your Skechers the same treatment you give your clothes. Just toss them in the washing machine and keep them looking brand spanking new. Find machine washable Skechers at a Skechers store, Skechers.com, or wherever stylish footwear happens to be sold.
The spirit of the American West is live and well in Range Magazine, the award-winning quarterly devoted to the issues affecting the American West. Each issue contains informative articles, breathtaking imagery, as well as the culture of cowboy spirit today, and gift ideas like the 2021 Real Buckaroo Calendar. Order online from rangemagazine.com. Loving Liberty Network salutes the spirit of the American West at rangemagazine.com.
Decades after Jimmy Carter, Joe Biden picked up where he left off. With America surrendering to terrorists, Biden's foolish spending is causing inflation, which means more pain at the pump, higher prices on groceries, devaluing your retirement savings when you need it most. Once was a mistake. Twice is a disaster. America needs strong leaders, not weak ones. Save America JFC is responsible for the content of this advertising.
Do you know what is great about America? Ask an Immigrant. Ask an Immigrant is a new podcast dedicated to helping Americans, especially our youth, value, appreciate, and be grateful for the freedoms we have here in America. Join host Lydia Wallace Nuttall as she interviews immigrants from around the world to discover their inspiring personal stories about why they came to America. To learn more about why America is the most prosperous, greatest country in the world, download the Loving Liberty app or go to lovingliberty.net.
In the medical field, IT security is crucial. Our highly skilled consultants are HIPAA certified and have 20 plus years of experience servicing medical clinics, billing, and supply companies. We offer comprehensive endpoint protection, guarding your computers and servers against all stages of threats. And with our 24/7 monitoring services, you'll never worry about extensive downtime again. Ready to level up your IT support? Call 801-706-6980 today and discover how great IT services can be with Managed IT Services.
Oh,
back, ladies and gentlemen, to Liberty Roundtable Live. This is Lowell Nelson, guest this morning, and Sam Bushman's great show, Liberty Roundtable. We've been talking about the state party nominating convention. Went through that a bit, and now moving on to another topic: the final nail in Americans' coffin, column by Ron Paul, which can be found at campaignforliberty.org. He begins this way, quote, "When future historians go searching for the final nail in the U.S. coffin, they may well settle on the date April 20, 2024. On that day, Congress passed legislation to fund 2.5 wars, hand what's left of our privacy over to the CIA and NSA, and give the U.S. president the power to shut down whatever part of the internet he disagrees with. The nearly $100 billion grossly misnamed National Security Supplemental guarantees that Ukrainians will continue to die in that country's unwinnable war with Russia, that Palestinian civilians will continue to be slaughtered in Gaza with U.S. weapons, and that the neocons will continue to push us toward a war with China." End of quote. Utah Celeste Malloy, by the way, voted for these things, and she took some flack for it at the convention on Saturday. But to be clear, of that $95 billion, $61 billion goes to Ukraine and $26 billion goes to Israel. Yeah, isn't it fun to give away someone else's money? Because that's what's happening. They get to look compassionate by giving away money to these countries, but it's not compassion at all. It's a death sentence for many of the people involved, especially those in Gaza and many of the Ukrainian army who lose their lives in this unwinnable war with Russia. So basically, Biden's team is sacrificing Ukraine lives because it doesn't want to be blamed for losing Ukraine before the elections in November later this year. Or at least that's what Paul is speculating. So here are the facts, Sam. Quote, "The U.S. and its allies have already sent over $300 billion to Ukraine, and the country is still losing its war with Russia. Nobody believes another $60 billion will pull a victory from the jaws of defeat. But this additional money is meant to keep up appearances until November at the expense of Americans who are forced to pay for it and Ukrainians who are forced to die for it." End of quote. Boy, Ron Paul really has a expressive, eloquent way of expressing it, this sentiment. So after the House voted to send more of your money to Ukraine, they waved Ukrainian flags on the House floor and chanted, "Ukraine, Ukraine, Ukraine." Yeah, which is pretty disgusting they did that. They overtly refused to follow the Constitution, Sam. The states did not vest in the general government any authority to send money to other countries. Foreign aid is not authorized. The states also did not authorize the general government to shut down websites. But the House trampled on the Constitution yet again and gave the president this faux authority to shut down websites that are foreign adversary controlled. And then continuing Paul's column, he says here, "Not to be outdone, the U.S. Senate on that same day passed the extension of Section 702 of the FISA Act, which not only allowed the government to continue spying on us without a warrant, but also contain new language massively expanding how they can spy on us." End of quote. Concluding his column, Ron Paul says this, quote, "What is the silver lining in all this bad news? Well, most Republicans in the House voted against continuing the Ukraine war. That's a good start. Our ideas are growing, not only across the country, but even in the D.C. swamp. Take courage and don't give up. Work for peace." End of quote. Exclamation Amen. Point. End of quote. I agree, Sam. What do you think about that?
I think Ron Paul's spot on. I think his columns are always educational. He has facts and details that most people don't know. And then he always delivers, in my opinion, the spot on what matters. You know, this could be the final nail in America's coffin if we, the people, allow these things to stand. You know, Judge Napolitano kind of follows up and talks about killing the Constitution. So while Ron Paul's saying last, you know, nail in the coffin, Judge Andrew Napolitano talking about they're killing the Constitution. It's called killing the Constitution. But this really highlights what's going on that people need to be aware of, Lowell.
And his column can be found at ronpaulinstitute.org. He reminds us that before East Germany, the wall in Berlin fell, then during this time in East Germany, laws were enacted that made it a felony to know of a crime but not report it to authorities. It was also a crime to tell someone you had ratted on him. There was no right to privacy, no freedom of speech. Okay, so this is in the 1980s before the wall fell, came down. This resulted, folks, in numerous false reports of crimes and many prosecutions for failing to report crimes or for warning others that they'd been spied upon. As of last week, Judge Knapp writes, quote, "We in America are headed to the same authoritarian place. Thanks to legislation that fell one vote short of demise in each house of Congress last weekend, America in 2024 will soon resemble East Germany in the late 1980s, where nearly everyone was a spy and no one could talk about it." And here's the backstory, writes Judge Napolitano. "The quintessential American right is the right to be left alone. Justice Louis Brandeis called it the most comprehensive of rights and the right most valued by civilized persons. It presumes that you can think as you wish and say what you think and read what you want and publish what you say, that you can exclude whomever you wish, including the government, from your property and from your thoughts, and that you can do all this without a government permission slip or fear of government reprisal. This natural right is also protected in the Fourth Amendment to the Constitution, which requires a warrant issued by a judge based upon probable cause of crime before the government can invade your property or spy on you." End of quote. So Napolitano then explains the three reasons that a government agent needs a warrant. Now, these three reasons are important. I'd never really read these before. They make perfect sense. Number one, to keep government in its lane of crime solving, not crime predicting, right? I mean, you may not search someone or his property by merely suspecting that a crime will be committed. You may, however, after a crime has been committed, and if you have probable cause that so-and-so did it, search that person or his property. See, this concern arose from the Stamp Act, whereby British agents could enter the home at your house and search it to see if its occupants had purchased government stamps required by the Stamp Act. Of course, the real reason the British agents were searching houses was not to look at your documents, but to find revolutionary material so the government could see who they had to watch real closely because they were planning to revolt against King George III. So that's the real reason for the Stamp Act and the real reason they were searching people's houses back then. Now, Judge Napolitano continues. He says the second purpose of the warrant requirement is to prevent fishing expeditions. Hence, the Fourth Amendment also requires that warrants specifically describe the place to be searched and the person or thing to be seized. And the third and most fundamental purpose of the warrant requirement, he says, continuing on, is to reduce to writing the right to privacy. All persons, even the federal spies themselves, now about 100,000 in number, want privacy. The framers knew this and believed they had guaranteed it in the Fourth Amendment. End of quote. But, writes Judge Knapp, they were wrong. And obviously, given our circumstances today, they were wrong. Because after Watergate, Congress passed FISA, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, which established a secret court to do what Americans, or to do to Americans, what the British had done to the colonists, issue broad general warrants based on whatever the government wanted and not specifying the place to be searched or the person or thing to be seized. Judge Knapp writes, quote, "When the courageous Edward Snowden, who had been both a CIA and an NSA agent, revealed the warrantless spying instead of curtailing it, Congress made it lawful, unconstitutional, but lawful," end of quote. Now here, Sam, Judge Knapp really should have said legal, not lawful. Congress made spying legal, albeit unconstitutional, but see, legal is not always lawful. And I believe we ought to be precise in our language insofar as possible. See, I am reminded of one of my favorite cartoons or memes, Sam, and I've mentioned this before, but you got the U.S. Constitution written on parchment with a rubber stamp being lifted up from the parchment and below the stamp the words, "Void where prohibited by law." See, of course, the Constitution may not be amended by congressional statute, yet that is exactly what is done so often nowadays. It's exactly what happened on April 20, just a week and a half ago.
Section and this several... lie that it can be legal but violate the Constitution is not true either. Okay, the
exactly.
supreme law of the land is the Constitution. That means supreme. If other laws can circumvent it, then it's not supreme anymore, is it?
Not at all. And Section 702 of FISA, which is the section of FISA that Congress voted last week to extend for 2 years, expressly authorizes the feds to spy on foreign persons and those with whom they communicate inside the U.S. and elsewhere without warrants. That means that if a foreign person communicates with an American, the feds can spy on the American as well without a warrant. The FISA
but they'll do it even if there's not a foreigner involved, though, because that's what George Bush got caught doing. And instead of, impeaching him and removing him and trying him for his gross crimes of violation of privacy, all Congress did was kind of backdoor endorse it. And they continue to expand it under the 702 lie that Mike Johnson just pushed through.
Exactly, Sam. And it seems to me basically they just scoop up everything. They capture everything that is said in a telephone conversation, that's texted by telephone, that's emailed. You know, they scoop up everything, and then they, with bots, they scour what they capture, looking for anything they can use to prosecute their political opponents. And I have it on good authority, Sam, from a friend who has been in the foreign intelligence, that they have been doing this, they meaning the government, has been scooping up this information for decades, long before Congress authorized it. And so it's just further down this pathway towards tyranny, towards serfdom, basically, that we're traveling with this new Section 702. So basically, if the cable installer tells you or refuses to spy on you, he may be subjected to the terrors that were common in East Germany before the wall came down. So, bottom line, Sam, this is a sobering analysis of our situation, and you really have to wonder why we allow our people in Congress to trample on the Constitution this way. Where is our right to privacy now? Where is our freedom of speech? Those are important questions to be asking. Where are the checks and balances
that prevent this, and who's violating those? And this is where, you know what, the most peaceful solution is to elect good, honest people, as we talked about at the first part of this program. That's why I spent so long on it. You have got to be involved in making sure that those who represent you understand their oath and have the integrity to carry that oath out. Those who violate the oath should absolutely be removed. And the founders felt like the people could remove them via the election process. We don't need term limits. We already have term limits. Just remove them. But it takes we the people to be involved, and that's the way our system is designed. I know it seems frustrating, but until we and our greater numbers get involved, you're going to have the same things happen. Students are fired up a little bit, aren't they, Lowell?
They sure are. They're going after the hypocritical public servants. Eric Margolis is widely respected as a journalist. His story can be found at ronpaulinstitute.org as well. He talks about university students going after the public servants in Washington, D.C., who are the hypocrites. The U.S. regime continues to finance and to arm and finance Israel's mass killing and starvation in Gaza for the sake of huge cash donations as elections loom later this year. The U.S. and British media have been whitewashing the genocide in Gaza and twisting their reporting to justify mass killing of civilians. The New York Times has earned opprobrium by ordering its staff to slant the news it misreports. This once great newspaper has ruined its reputation. It reminds of the great Mark Twain's famous quote, "If you don't read the news, you are uninformed. If you do, then you are misinformed." Great Mark Twain quote there. In his opinion, Sam, that President Joe Biden, Israel's Benjamin Netanyahu, and their pal Egypt's despot Abdel el-Sisi are directly responsible for the deaths of 14,000 Palestinian children, almost 35,000 Palestinian civilians seriously wounded, and some 2 million Palestinians now homeless, and also responsible for the growing starvation and disease across Gaza, used by Israel as a refuse dump for unwanted Arabs. Boy, Eric is very punchy in his writing, too. The Biden administration is providing over $14.1 billion in arms to Israel, including the deadly 2,000-pound bombs used to crush entire civilian apartment buildings and hospitals, plus tank shells fired at residential targets, all in clear violation of U.S. arms export laws written by Congress. Well, why would Biden be doing this? Why would our U.N. delegation veto resolutions to stop Israel from laying waste to Gaza? Well, because election time is upon us, folks. This year, big election.
And ladies and gentlemen, let's be clear. The president doesn't have authority to do this at all. Congress hasn't declared war. Congress funds it in a backhanded slap kind of a way to where if it goes well, they can all take credit. If it goes bad, they can blame it on the president. This is disaster. And every time we have a problem in America, it's because they violate the checks and balances that our supreme law calls for, Lowell.
Yeah, and Eric says further here, Israelis are right to be furious over the killing of an estimated 1,139 Israeli civilians and soldiers from last October, but killing tens of thousands of innocent Arabs, that's wildly out of proportion and clearly criminal. And the students at universities, they understand this, and that's why they're protesting the massacres in Gaza. And, you know, these numbers, Sam, I just don't hear these over the lamestream media. 14,000 Palestinian children killed, 35,000 civilians seriously wounded. I mean, yeah, I haven't heard the lamestream media.
The reason you don't hear that is because
that.
They don't want you to be incensed and put pressure on your Congress and pressure on your president to stop this. That's why. They love it. They love war. They get a lot of money from war. They get backing from Congress, backing from the president. The circle of dishonesty continues as the military-industrial complex continues, and we the people have got to stop it. Nobody else will. Our greater numbers can stop it, but you got to get involved to do it now.
Absolutely right, Sam. Totally right. Now, we've been talking about some pretty sobering, serious stuff, and I wanted to end the show on a little more positive note, Sam. And I want to talk about what started the war for independence in the 1770s, right? I mean, and I thoroughly enjoy the articles posted at 10thAmendmentCenter.com. Michael Bolden does a great job there. He wrote this column on April 19th, posted it on April 19th, because that is the day, right, when the war for independence began, had conquered. But before I tell you the answer, here's the question, Sam. What started the war for independence? What was the direct catalyst that started the war for independence? Want to take a stab at it?
Well, so the abuses were plenty, ladies and gentlemen. The abuses were many. The abuses were justified. Go look at the Declaration of Independence for all the abuses highlighted there as justification before God in a candid world. But that alone, and this is the point that I want to make, the founders were very careful. They did not want war. They did not want this to start. They hoped to solve this peacefully at every turn. However, there was a quintessential change in the abusers' attacks. And when that change occurred, they said, we cannot cross this line, Lowell.
Exactly right, Sam. Obviously, high taxes, excessive regulation, and warrantless searches were the fuel for the rebellion. But the spark, that's what we're talking about, the spark that started this war, what finally forced the Patriots into a shooting war with the British Army at Lexington and Concord on April 19, 1775, was one of the many attempts by the British to disarm Americans as part of an overall gun control program. And so here's the British plan, Sam, supported by Lord Dartmouth and General Gage. In fact, Gage felt that Dartmouth's suggestion of disarming the inhabitants of the Massachusetts Bay, Connecticut, and Rhode Island was a fantastic idea and was consistent with prudence and safety. Notice those words, prudence and safety. It's fascinating, Sam, how the gun grabbers always say that gun control is for the safety of the citizenry, right? That's what they said in 1774, just like they say today. It's amazing.
Yeah, I don't think the founders felt safe under King George, and especially when he decided to come for their only singular reality in terms of stopping him and fighting back, right?
That's right. So in 1774, Gage sent 250 redcoats to conduct a seizure at the Charleston Powder House, and a smaller detachment he sent to Cambridge to seize two artillery pieces. Well, word of the seizures and the troop movement spread quickly, You know, there wasn't just Paul Revere riding the horse around the colonies. Rumors started flying that shots were fired. The Navy was shelling Boston, known today as the Powder Alarm. As many as 20,000 militia members, Sam, 20,000 responded to a call and started streaming toward Boston. Several thousand showed up in Cambridge and intimidated some loyalists into fleeing. So Gage then tried a different tactic. So that was in September, right? So then Gage tried a different tactic, warrantless searches to find arms and ammunition. And, of course, that made the colonists very angry. Meanwhile, King George III forbade the importation of arms and ammunition without a permit. Sound familiar? Well, guess what? Nobody got a permit. So by the middle of December, John Langdon and John Sullivan led some militia to seize gunpowder and artillery before the Redcoats could get them. Lord Dartmouth pushed Gage to go harder with gun control. Quote, all cannon, small arms, and other military stores of every kind that may be either in any magazine or secreted for the purpose of aiding in the rebellion should also be seized and secreted. End of quote. That's what Dartmouth told Gage. And so Gage acted promptly and just 4 days later issued orders that 700 plus troops were to assemble during the night for a mission to seize arms stored by the colonial militia at Concord. Okay, so on April 19th, 1775, that's when the shots were fired at Concord because the Redcoats were coming to confiscate their firearms. So it bears repeating, Sam, the fighting at Lexington and Concord wasn't because the British Army came to collect taxes. It was because of gun control. Sam?
And ladies and gentlemen, let's be very clear. And I know the FBI listens to this show and the Secret Service and everybody, you know, you don't need to record it, ladies and gentlemen, of the FBI. You can just download it at libertyroundtable.com. I make it available every day just for you. So you don't even got to go to the extra work of recording everything we say. We'll do it for you. But I want to make this very clear. If you don't have tyrants seeking for power and abusing the citizenry, violating our rights to privacy, and okay, if you don't do those things, then you won't have a rebellion. Okay, the founding fathers did not even want to rebel against King George. But he made it untenable. He made it to where they just could not tolerate it any longer. And then when they came for the guns, they said, listen, we wanted to be peaceful. We've endured a ton. Look at the Declaration of Independence to prove how much we've endured. We cannot allow this last line of defense to fall. If the people are disarmed, the government will have all the power. And the government is drunk with power. Look at King George. He's out of control. The same thing is reality today. I submit to you, all government officials, all appointed and elected and whatever, everywhere, in all branches of government everywhere, from the top, your local, you know, government, all the way to the bottom, Washington, D.C. Yes, I have that right, not backwards. You guys have it all backwards. All right. Everybody, you have delegated authority by the peaceful consent of the governed. If you act in accordance with that, we have no issue. We have no problem. The more you violate those principles, the more you seek for power, the more you're drunk with secret combinations, the more you abuse and grind the face of the poor and destroy our liberties and violate our privacy, the more you will have eventually resistance to that. My prayer is that the resistance can remain peaceful and that you guys will obey the law, as were the founders hoping that King George would do that. King George proved to be too belligerent. I pray they're not too belligerent in our day. But I'm afraid it's getting that way rather rapidly, Lowell.
Well, and we do have some very peaceful solutions, nullification being one of them. As long as the local and state agents of government will refuse to cooperate with the tyranny imposed by officials in Washington, D.C., then we will have a peaceful resolution to this tyranny, right?
And amen so to that.
That's why we need Phil Lyman in the governor's mansion in Utah, and that's why we need, you know, good public servants at every level, state, local, and national, Sam, to
we the people as sovereigns under God have all the authority and control if we use it peacefully and properly, ladies and gentlemen. For Lowell Nelson, campaignforliberty.org, Dr. Scott Bradley, freedomsrisingsun.com, and yours truly, libertyroundtable.com, lovingliberty.net, God save the Republic of the United States of America. Thanks, everybody.